Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I'm Barry Rabe. I'm a professor here at the Ford School and the director of the sponsor of today's event, Close Up, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. I'm very pleased to have all of you with us and very, very delighted to be able to welcome our team of colleagues who have been working on this project for some time, a presentation that will be made by George Fulton, and then we'll be transitioning toward Q&A issues. But let me begin by introducing George, who's certainly known to many of you and has really played an extraordinary role in a number of arenas, including illuminating a range of issues concerning the Michigan economy and the future of Michigan economies over really a number of years, a tremendous public service. George is the director of the Research Seminar in Quantitative Economics, holds a number of other roles. He's joined today in co-authorship of this report by Don Grimes, who's the assistant director of the Center for Labor and Market Research. They are two of three co-authors of a report which Close Up is releasing today, and you're going to be hearing more about in a moment, called Transformation of America's Metropolitan Area Economies. This is such an interesting time to be thinking about the future challenges and issues of urban political economy. If I understand it correctly, this started initially as a project comparing Detroit and Pittsburgh, a smaller direct comparison, two very interesting political economies, Rust Belt systems that had shifted, but has now become a much larger project with far more than Detroit and Pittsburgh in it, although both of those are there, and really stretching over quite an extended period of time. So this is a very, very rich analysis. We will turn to George for the overview and then allow for questions and answers. We will follow our standard format, which is to invite you to submit questions on note cards that are being distributed or have been distributed. We do this in large part to make sure that the voice is picked up for videotaping and the like. So begin to think even now about questions that you would want to raise. And my close-up colleague, Tom Ivaca, will be working with me to sort through some of those questions as they come in. And also, Tom will be also offering a couple of additional questions as well. With that, delighted to welcome George Fulton. George.
Well, good afternoon. And thank you for that. Thank you for that introduction. First, I want to thank Close Up for its funding of this project and also for arranging. Can you all hear me? For arranging this event today, and also the office of the provost kicked in a few funds, and so I want to thank them as well. And welcome. I want to acknowledge my co-authors, as Barry already did. First, we have Don Grimes, who's sitting right here. And after I'm finished, he's going to answer all of your questions. And then the third author is Yuan Li Zhu, and he was the technician in this paper, and he has moved on to Ford Motor Company. Still there, I think, right? Yes. Okay. And so he's not with us. He's not with us today. I want to do also thank Jackie Murray for editing the paper that is on the working paper that's now on the Close Up website, for all the layout and for these really pretty slides you're going to see today. So, the title of our report is Transformation of America's Metropolitan Area Economies: Lessons from Four Decades. And before I go into that, I wanted to show you a cartoon which I thought was relevant. You see? Oops. There it is. I paid you enough. I spent the last hour trying to get this on this show. Well, but I'm technically not proficient here, but I thought it was relevant. It shows some guy that has just got clubbed over the head with a with a sledgehammer, and the guy who slugged him is this real brutal guy with a shirt on that says January. And the guy is just coming and ready to turn around the corner, and he doesn't see a similar looking guy carrying a sledgehammer that says February. And I just wanted it made me think that I really do need to thank you for coming today in this weather. And also, if this Club E is a metro area, is getting clubbed in the prior period prologued to getting clubbed in the next period? So we'll see. We'll see in the presentation. So just before I get into it, I want to tell you a little bit about me. When I started my career, I talked to a very esteemed colleague. Was not a colleague, actually. Was an academic at another place. And he said to me, you know, I was trying to figure out what to do professionally. And he said, well, everyone gets one good idea in their life. And whether you're successful or not depends on whether you recognize it and cash in on it. And so I'm still hoping my one good idea is still coming. But if I did have one good idea, I guess it is to do this economic research on local and regional and state economies. And of course, I was advised then, actually, to not do that. It wasn't by Paul. And the three reasons were, well, it doesn't have any cachet. The national is much sexier. Two, no one's ever going to care about regional stuff. And number three is you're going to spend your whole 80% of your career dealing with data issues and constructing data. Well, only one of those three turned out to be true, and that is the data issue. So I just want you to keep in mind today as we go through this that data issues were really a major issue in this study. We spent months on it before we even looked at our first equation. And it's why many of the concepts that might make sense to you, and some of them that you've recommended to me to explain economic success in these localities, are not in our models because they didn't fit our strict measurement expectations. So I just want to start by that. So in this study, we look at the questions of what leads metro economies to function the way they do, what makes some of them more successful than others, and what policy handles, if any, can improve their profiles. And the primary tool we use is econometric modeling analysis, and I will, I think, by and large, make that accessible to everyone here today. So let's start by talking about what I think the innovations in this study are, and then I will get into the results. The first thing is that we extended the database for metro areas to 40 years, 1969 to 2009. And that's much longer than is typical for small economic regions. The data limitations in this stuff are so severe when you're analyzing these small economies that inferences on the effectiveness of economic drivers and policy handles are often drawn from very narrow time intervals that will not reflect all the behavioral relationships outside the period. So we said, no, we've got to go with longer periods, that's one thing. And so that means the data restrictions have to be dealt with. So we expended really a great effort to expand the time range of our data. And this involved ensuring that you had consistent metro area definitions over time, because they change, and we made sure that they were consistent. We spent a lot of time in Paul's library looking up some of the old stuff and copying numbers out of books, and you might remember that's how we did it back then. So then the second thing is we want to take advantage of the longer time period of available data to segment the estimation period into sequential subintervals. And I'm going to come back to that one in a minute. Then we made a considerable investment in assembling new series for variables that we judge to be promising economic drivers. For example, we individually hand-coded 2 million plus records on patents, one by one, and almost as many on crime rates. And those are just two of the variables. So that was a huge investment, and you're always hoping that that'll pay off. The fourth thing is we wanted to look at spatial differences among select regions of the country. Okay, do things look different in our region than they do in the nation? And we focused our attention there on the Rust Belt, which we defined as the Midwest and Northeast regions of census regions. Okay, and then, due to my friend Paul Courant, we recognized that our models wouldn't fit all of the metro areas well, what he called the tyranny of best practices. When we assume that we estimate these things over 366 metro areas, then assume that all of the favorable statistical assumptions are met, you know, random residuals and so on, and so that it applies to all of them. And he said, well, why don't you see if that's the case? So we did an analysis of the residuals to identify the metro areas that showed the least confirmation to the general model. We found some interesting stuff. And so we'll get into that in this talk. Now, just going back to the second point, we estimated these equations for two sequential 20-year subintervals. So we had 40 years of data, two sequential 20-year subintervals. And we wanted to ascertain what changes in the economic relationships could be identified between the earlier and the later periods, while still avoiding the criticism of having intervals that are too short. So we used our 20-year. Our curiosity on this was motivated by observing how volatile these small economies were over shorter segments of time. That is, any one decade is not prologue to the next decade. Okay? So the guy that got clubbed on the head when he turned the corner isn't necessarily there, got a guy waiting for him. And that I can show you here on the next slide. These are metro area rankings based on the change in personal income minus transfers per capita. Okay? And I want you to note in particular the movements in the first two areas that are listed, Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Midland, Texas. So over the whole period, Bridgeport was first in the change in income. But in 69 to 79, it was 73rd, then it was first, then it was second, and then in the last decade listed there, it was 347th out of 366. Okay, another one is Midland, Texas. 14, 2, 356, 248, 4. Okay, and part of that, of course, is the energy market there. And so if you look at the others, there's more stability, a little more stability, but they still move around quite a bit. So that's what we started with. And then if you look at the paper, this analysis is all followed by a fairly extensive literature review. In fact, one of my colleagues that read the paper said, there's too many pages on the literature review. So I'm not going to run through that. I thought as a strategy here is I would go right to show you our estimating results. And then when I'm done, I can show you in a table how they compare with what the previous literature said to the extent that the variables were there. Okay, so let's start with the model. This is our general model specification. We use two dependent variables, which is change in Y. One was specifically real dollar change in personal income minus transfers per capita. And the second was the percentage change in total metro area employment. The independent variables that you see there are included at the beginning of each of these intervals, and the dependent variable measured this change over the time interval. And so, of course, now the trick is to get proxy measures for each of those variables that are in the parentheses in this equation. And what I'm going to do is I take you through a few tables. You'll see what those are. So let's start, and I'm not going to hit everything. There's thousands of regressions in this project, let's hit some high points. And so this is the chart we designed so that I didn't put up all of these things with coefficients and standard errors, and you can't even see them from the back. So I hope this helps. The way this chart is laid out is we have the variables in the first column, and then in the next two columns are the results for our two income models, early period and later period. And then the last two columns are the early and later periods for employment. And the sign of the coefficient is in the cells, and the purple cells indicate that it was significant at the 5% level using the p-values. And the asterisk indicates that that particular variable didn't go in that equation. Okay. So if we look at the first line, which is the initial income levels, you can see that they have a positive effect on the change in per capita income over the period, but in fact the effect has dwindled over the two periods. Not only is it less significant, the coefficient is smaller. Okay, so that's an example. I think a more interesting one here is the initial population size in one of these areas, and you can see that its effect on per capita income is positive. We interpret that as agglomeration economies in large areas, but this effect seems to be dwindling over time as firms have a lessening need to congregate for production efficiencies. So let's go to the industry structure. I'm not going to do all of these. In working in several decades, let's say, of working on these regional things, I think the most fundamental answer, most fundamental thing that I've learned is the industry makeup of local economies is integral to their economic success patterns. Okay, and for instance, you see the mining share there variable, and you can see that in the income equation the signs flip, and that reflects the vagaries of the oil market. So you can see if you just estimated a decade, you could get some misleading results on that. If you look at manufacturing and durables collectively, you can see that that is a negative sign, which shows the negative impact of manufacturing sector over time. And I think one of the, actually in many ways, one of the best studies in the literature on this just looked at one decade, which was the 1990s, and they found a positive sign on the share of manufacturing, because that decade happened to have a little resurgence in manufacturing, and they made a deal of that. And I think that was misleading. Okay. Let's see what else we have here. Okay, just a couple others. It's interesting that the share of finance and insurance is always positive, always significant, and a few other studies that use that variable, it's always positive and it's always significant. And I think that reflects the higher value service sector orientation there. And then, of course, you see the growing influence of health services. And, you know, whether that's going to continue is a topic for discussion. But we are the only ones that I know in this literature that actually looked at that particular industry. Okay. Now, I think the demographic results were, in our results, were largely puzzling or uninteresting. You know, I'd like to just click past this one, but the income employment results for the foreign-born population actually suggest a disproportionate numbers of lower-paid workers in this group, although it's not significant. What's interesting, by the way, in the Rust Belt, it's the other way around, higher paid. The most puzzling result in this entire study was the positive and significant effect in the later period on the share of the population in poverty. So more people in poverty in the initial period led to higher growth in income, higher employment. So, you know, this is research. We don't hide anything here. This could be a statistical problem, and we realize that, although we hashed this around quite a bit. If we're going to say, yeah, that's the correct result, and we're going to try and think of something, which we, you know, we can think of something, we can posit that higher poverty levels initially prompted more activity in programs to assist the poor. Having said that, I think that seems to be a bit of a stretch. So, then we have the share of the population 65 or older, and it's in there to represent the lower labor force participation rates of that cohort. It wasn't a factor in our model, and by the way, it wasn't a factor in any study that I could find that looked at it. So, I guess the, well, I won't make a comment about older people.
especially I'm about to join them.
Yeah. So now let's look at the innovative environment here. And an innovative environment is increasingly viewed to be an important driver of economic growth. The argument is that scientific development promotes economic development. So in terms of our new measures of patents granted, two groups that stand out are IT patents and industrial patents. And the impact of the industrial patents strengthens in the later period. So that was encouraging, and we spent considerable effort on putting that series together, so we were glad that at least it seems to have some benefit to the model. Now, the most disappointing result in our work was this research expenditures. It's actually university research expenditures. I'm glad you're still not the provost. Now, do I believe this? No. I think the fact that we have educational attainment, which you'll see in a minute, and the granting of patents into our equations could be confounding the results here. The interesting thing to me is other studies that have looked at this with other combinations of variable have also found mixed results. But it's really difficult to believe that the research and technology creation functions of universities, if they're isolated and measured properly, do not result in enhanced regional economic development that otherwise would not occur. Now, of course, in a place like the world-famous University of Michigan, a lot of these benefits are not just contained in Washtenaw County, so they spill out. Okay, now here's, I think, an interesting slide. These are the variables related to policy decisions. Gerald R. Ford School, we should take a look at this. I think the two most compelling variables in this set are educational attainment and crime. Educational attainment is measured by the share of the population with a bachelor's degree or higher. Now, we tried other measures. I know it's not all about just bachelor's degrees and that, but this one really is the one that stood out. Our results are consistently positive, but only, and by the way, in other studies, they're always positive. But in our study, only significant for income. And I think that's consistent with the general rationale, which I will put out here, that more educated regions are becoming more economically successful because they're becoming more productive. And productivity, of course, is a double-edged sword. Now, the crime rate is one of the strongest variables in our model. And in a way, I'm happy from a research point of view, because we spent an enormous amount of time putting this together. And I think it emphasizes the importance of deterring crime, especially considering that the effect on income was actually larger over time. Now, we thought, well, we also had, we put together a series on violent crime as well, and property crime. So we thought, well, maybe we should test out the violent crime and see if that's even more significant. And we just ended up settling on total crime as a measure for various reasons, which I won't get into now. But we did certainly look at violent crime. Now we get into the more controversial variables. State and local government tax as a percent of personal income. And so this is an age-old problem in state legislatures and that. Whenever we go and do testimony twice a year, it always comes up. And half of the people say we should be doing more of this, and the other half say we shouldn't be doing this, and I say I don't have any information on it. It turns out that the effect of state and local taxes on the change in income and employment was usually negative. That's true of other studies too. But I have to say, talking to people that specialize in this, which obviously we don't, that this representing this is really fraught with complications. It's very complicated to put a really good tax burden number together. So I do have to give you that caveat, but that I will. Okay, we'll skip over the next one. No, we won't. We included in our equations a dummy variable for location in a right-to-work state. So is the metro area in a right-to-work state? If the metro area crossed border state boundaries, we assigned it to the state where its major city resided. So we had to do a lot of fiddling. So this is a dummy variable with a value of 1 representing the presence of the legislation. So if the legislation's there, it's one. You can see that this variable was usually positive, and it was significant for both income and employment in the later period. We interpret this variable more generally as representing a more general business-friendly environment rather than more narrowly as a union avoidance measure. And indeed, if you're going to argue it as a union avoidance measure, you might expect a negative sign on income and a positive sign on employment, which is the argument, as I understand it. I think on this variable, this one is one, it's so politically charged, and one really needs to be very careful about this, because it really does take some time after the enactment of the legislation, I think, for the effect to actually be reflected in results like this. So if one were going to dig deeper here, and we didn't, but if one were to go dig deeper here, I think it makes some sense to go back and look at the tenure of this legislation over states and take a look at the states that have had the legislation in place for longer periods of time and see, try to determine what effect those have on economic outcomes, because these things don't happen instantly. A right-to-work state, okay, next day, everything's positive, or employment's positive, income's negative, or, all of the arguments. So I leave with those thoughts on it. The other thing, of course, that's become increasingly important is the economy's becoming more global. And the connectivity to the outside world has become more important. And we measure that by air traffic. We looked at freight as well, didn't work as well. And we find a positive and significant effect on employment in both periods there. And we'll come back to that when we look at the rest of the literature. Okay, how about amenities? I didn't think they were so funny. The problem is, and we chatted with Barry and Tom about this before we came here, is that you have person-made amenities and you have natural amenities. Well, person-made amenities are very difficult to measure, especially if you're trying to get a measure for 40 years over 366 metro areas. That's consistent and good. But that hasn't stopped people, of course, from trying to look at what they call natural amenities. And until our study, I could find no study that did anything different than putting in the July temperature or the January temperature or both temperatures. In our case, we got more mileage out of looking at the difference in the two and arguing that more moderate temperatures are attractive. And you can see all the negative signs, but there is a positive sign for employment at the end. And I think that's just, in my view, too narrow a measure of climate, but I understand why people do it, because you can get it. Well, we stumbled across this natural amenity scale. It's published by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and it looks at natural amenities in six different dimensions. Okay? So do you have water? Do you have mountains? Are your summer temperatures, and it had lots of things that I think we would all agree are attractive. And so we put that in, and indeed it worked in the employment equation. It was positive amenities in the earlier period, and positive, but not significant in the second period. And one wonders, perhaps, if those kind of natural amenities are becoming less important for people that are businesses that are seeking locations, but that's that I don't know. So let me see. Now, what I want to do quickly is, how do we line up with previous studies? So I kind of summarize these pages and pages of literature review. So what I did here is put a brief summary table together. This isn't in the paper. It is non-rigorous, but I thought it would be helpful in the discussion. In the first column after the variables, P stands for expected positive sign, N for expected negative sign, and the question mark for the fact that it was indeterminate in a priori in the literature. Okay, the second column indicates whether the variable was usually significant. NA stands for no presence in the literature or very little presence in the literature, other than our study. The next column indicates whether the variables in our study were significant. Earlier means earlier period, later means later period, usually means usually, and then I have some notes. So for the initial period population size, for example, in a time interval, our results are usually significant. It indicates a positive effect on employment change. As I told you before, that represents agglomeration economies, and a negative effect on employment, which suggests that larger metro areas are more prone to declining employment over time, although that seems to be weakening over time as well. So let's go to the structure. And I think all I want to point out here is that the share of health services, which isn't in any other studies, appears to be becoming more prominent over time. Often variables besides manufacturing and finance matter, and in these studies that's just about all you get. And of course I've talked about mining. Where's mining? Oops. That's in other. And often these share variables are significant. So we have mining in for the energy metropolitan areas. We have military for those that have large military bases, and those all matter in those areas. Okay. What about, I think what stands out in the next slide is the contribution of our patent variables to represent innovation, especially for IT and industrial patents. And as I said before, that's heartening because we spent so much time putting those together. Now we go to the policy-related variables. My first impression here is that among these policy-related variables, there are a lot of consistencies in of the findings among previous studies and our study. And I think the second thing is the largest contribution, I think, here for our study is the crime rate variable, which is strong in our model and not present in other models. And again, that was heartening for us because we spent a lot of time putting that one together. And then off to the amenities again. We have our more comprehensive measure than the traditional measure of temperature with the National Amenities in Scale from the Agricultural Department. And you can see how we can, no one else has that one. And then there was one study, because I thought a question would come up, what about corruption? I don't know why that would enter your mind about local economies, but someone thought about this, and so they somehow had a measure for it, and they found that there was a negative relationship between corruption and economic outcomes, but it was not significant. And so I'm not touting that. I'm just saying that's what the study said. Okay. Now, the other thing, one other thing we did, as I told you, is we repeated this entire estimation effort for two subregions of the country. One is the Rust Belt, which we defined as being made up of the Midwest and Northeast census regions of the nation, and then the rest of the country. And our purpose there was to explore whether there were important spatial differences in our results. Fear not. I'm not going to step through all of these results. They're all in the paper. Instead, I'm just going to make a few summary observations. First, we did find that there were sufficient differences in national and regional results that there is benefit in estimating regional equations when the region is of primary interest. And then we also found that there were effects of some policy-related variables that were consistent across geographies. The consistent effects for income growth across these geographies were supporting education and deterring crime, and the consistent effects for employment growth were providing an innovative environment for industry, enhancing airport connectivity, and being good stewards of the natural environment. Okay, so now we go to the Paul-inspired analysis. And so what we did next is investigate the pattern of the residuals generated by our four national models. In other words, the earlier and later periods for the change in both real per capita income and the change in employment. And we did this for two reasons. We did it for three. The first one was to try to further validate the model, which a lot of people don't do. And the second was, of course, to identify those metro areas that did not conform well to the fit of the general model. And the third reason is Paul told us to do it. And so, you know, that's what we do. We don't know of any other study of this genre that did this, which in a way implies that these models, those models there, are thought to be well-behaved with random errors. Well, when you're estimating the economic behavior of hundreds of metro areas across the country with the severe data limitations that are inherent, it really is unlikely that the models will be so well-behaved. So the question is, where are the outliers? What didn't work so well? And is there any organized pattern to these outliers that can give us a clue of what we might be missing? Okay. So I'll show you the graphical residual analysis of all four models, but I'm really just going to focus on... I'm just going to focus on the last one. In all of them, the residuals are plotted against the estimated change in the relevant dependent variable. And the circled numbers you see in the graph are associated with a key that lines up the outliers. These are more than two standard deviations from the mean, and the legend gives you the metro area names. And I'll show you just one example shortly. Okay, got to say a technical thing. The residuals for the 366 metro areas are studentized, which means the residual value is divided by an estimate of the standard deviation, a standard technique in the detection of outliers. So I'm sure I preempted lots of questions there. A general observation is that the model fits the income change variables better than the employment change variables, at least in the sense that there appears to be no systematic pattern in the outliers in both income models. In both income models, the outlier residuals are evenly distributed in sign, and there are no clear geographic patterns. Okay, here's the plot of the residuals for the later period change in income, and now I'll move to employment. And this is the results for the employment change in the earlier period. And these are a little different story, which makes them more interesting, but also introduces more concerns. we find two tendencies in these employment models. First, most of the outliers are positive, meaning that those metro areas are outperforming in employment what the models understand. And second, most of the outliers are found in the south and west regions of the country. So how come? What's going on here? What are we missing in these areas? So I'm going to go to the later period, which is the one I'm going to look at a little. Here, all 10 of the outliers, as I defined it, that we identified, all 10 are located in the south and west regions of the country. And so here they are. Look at number one, Paul. If someone wants to know what's going on in St. George, Utah, we have an expert in the room, and so I'll pass that question on to him. Now, we didn't in this study try to uncover all that was going on here, okay? At some point, you got to stop. We see that as a topic for future research. But we said, let's try to make an initial pass at trying to account for some of the strong employment growth in these areas that isn't being picked up adequately in our model. So here we hypothesized that this rapid growth could be due in part to lesser geographic or legal restrictions on growth in these areas. And here are the data that we came up for those measures. Okay. It turns out that there are data available for 11 of the 21 outlier regions that we identified in either employment model. The land use variable that's in the third column is a z-score, where smaller values, including negative values, represent looser regulation. So this is stringency of land use regulations. And we expected if it was loose, that was more opportunity to grow. The other column is the land availability variable, and that's the percentage of land, divided by 100 if you like, that's accessible to develop. So you can't develop wetlands according to this measure. You can't develop land that's on steep slopes. And so those are ruled out. Okay. It turns out that these hypotheses are fairly consistent for the seven areas that you see on this first slide. They basically have loose regulations and available land. Okay? Miami at the bottom has a negative residual, but it is appropriately combined with strong regulations and little available land. Now, the hypothesis works less well for the four areas that are on this slide, particularly the last two. Okay, so we're only getting part of the way to understanding this. One other possibility, of course, in these models is that we're dealing with outside or exogenous shocks that are fairly significant in these regions, and you wouldn't expect them to be in the models. For example, in Laredo, Texas, which is a town right on the Mexican border, the introduction of NAFTA in the 90s gave this area a significant shift in the arm. Another example would be the introduction of casino gaming in the 1970s. Gave quite a boost to Atlantic City, New Jersey. And remember, we're not talking about the nation here. These are relatively small areas. And I can give you other examples. So some of the large misses might not be due to internal modeling shortcomings. And I'll just leave it at that. Okay, so let me... After talking away here, let me consolidate what I think some of our main findings are. This is the point to pay attention if you haven't been. The strongest indicators of the well-being of a metro area, which are also found in previous studies, are the initial conditions in the area, the industry structure, educational attainment, business-friendly environment and airport connectivity. We added the crime rate, the innovative environment, represented by industrial and IT patents, and amenities associated with the natural environment. The other thing we wanted to stress here is the impact of economic drivers can change over time. That was the whole idea of doing these segments and following them through and see if all of these are at least intuitively pleasing to you. And these were all that we pulled out of the model. The shrinking effect of agglomeration economies. Does consolidation for production, is it as important as it used to be? The growing influence of health services. The increasing importance of industrial innovation. The expanding negative impact of crime on regional income. Those all rest well with me. On the research method, a couple of points. I think estimation over longer time periods is important if you're going to interpret these coefficients correctly. More and better measures of local economies are called for. And it's important to identify metro areas that are outliers to the estimates. Okay, finally, does public policy matter on this stuff? It's sort of the bottom line, right? And I'm standing here at the Gerald Ford School of Public Policy and going to give my opinion on that. I've been coached prior. No, I haven't. I said, say what you want. Some people say no. Economic success, and here's two arguments. Economic success rests with decisions made by individual firms based on their products, process, and location decisions reflecting personal preferences of company leadership. Okay? Second one, it's right out of the literature. Urban growth is largely based on idiosyncrasy, fate, and history. What's our view? Our view is that although many of the drivers of metro area economies have longer time horizons to affect change, there is an opportunity to move economies onto a more favorable long-term growth path with sensible policy-induced change. What are some of these sensible things? That's how I'll close on. Such as educational attainment, business-friendly environment, airport connectivity, crime deterrence, innovative environment, and amenities associated with the national environment. So I guess my conclusion is all of us in this room are relevant. Okay. We're all validated. And so good night and good luck. Don and Barry will now take your questions.
Thank you, George, for saying what you wanted to say. Don, if you'll come up here for the panel. And I'm delighted to welcome my close-up colleague, Tom Ivacco, to share a series of questions, many of which have emerged here from the audience. Tom.
I'm not trying to dodge questions, but we're delighted to have discussion as well as just hitting us with questions.
That sounds good. Yeah, if there are any follow-ups as I put the questions to them, please feel free. I also want to point out, just so you all know, the microphone here is not for the room. That's actually just to pick up for the video. So, first of all, thank you both very much. This was really almost a tour de force of economic research. The data set that you put together was just an enormous amount of work, and I think will go to very good use in the future as well. So the first question is, this is a complex study. This is kind of the big question here, I think. But you guys are the economic forecasters. So can you speculate a little bit and tell us what you think the implications are really for future growth in Southeast Michigan and Detroit over the next 20 years or so?
Yeah. Okay, you want me to answer that?
You're on.
I think actually if you looked at the fact that everything sort of shifted every decade, and that maybe we're entering a period that the growth in the Detroit area is going to be a little more positive than people expect. All I can think about is back when we were presenting our long-run forecast to SEMCOG in the late 1990s, we had a forecast for their performance for looking out 30 years, I think, and our results were a lot less favorable than what your members expected. They were thinking that the economy was continued to boom. They had just gone through the 1990s, which were where the metro area of Detroit was in the top quartile of all metro areas in the country. The unemployment rate was extremely low. They thought things were just going to continue. And when we presented results that were, I mean, continuing to grow, but at a lot slower pace than they expected, they were unhappy. And they thought we were wrong. Of course, then in the next 10 years, things turned out to be even worse than we were expecting. And then a few years ago, we were presenting another long-run forecast, revised, into the SEMCOG region. And we had growth turning around in 2000, and starting when we were presenting this in 2010, 2011. And everybody was sitting there thinking, nah, we're going to go through another future that's been just like the last 10 years. And, of course, as things have turned out, things have gotten better. So I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think things people have to realize, take this longer-term perspective, as George emphasized, that look at what's happened over 20 or 30 or 40 years and not look at sort of something that's going to happen over the last 10, which can be misleading. So I think that overall things are going to look a little better for the next 10 years than they have. Of course, that's sort of maybe we get to the 2020s and maybe we'll get into a down cycle again. But it does look like things are going to be doing better than the 2000s.
Yeah, I think our mindsets tend to be auto-regressive. I remember an Outlook conference dinner in the late 90s, and we had a speaker, and he said the business cycle was dead. And he took on everyone in the room, and he was quite adamant about it. And, well, you know, the late 90s, and then now we move forward to after the first decade of the aughts, and when we were turning out forecasts that said the economy's turning around in Michigan, we got trashed. How can that be? It was terrible in 8, it was terrible in 9. How can it be better? And so I think just to elaborate on Don's point, also, it's the only question we know how to answer, so we're just dragging it on a bit.
Well, then I'm going to throw a tough question at you.
No.
Technical question. Regarding state and local taxes in the model, do you also control for state and local expenditures? One would expect the partial relationship to be negative for tax but positive for spending.
Yeah, we don't have that in the model, but that is certainly a good point. You know, obviously there are people that argue, and I think argue correctly, that firms and people are attracted to places that are going to offer them good services. And some of those services have to be paid for by tax revenues. And so I think that's I think that is the other side of that coin.
And that may explain why the tax variable is not significant, because obviously some of that also creates a positive effect through this government expenditure. And so that essentially, all other things equal, maybe lower taxes. But if lower taxes pay for lower services, then you don't get as big an effect as some of the theoretical. I mean, theoretically, it should have a negative effect, but you have to control for everything else, which means what do you do with the money? Or if you don't have the money, what you don't do with it?
The study found somewhat of a mixed impact from natural amenities such as bodies of water and so on, as you discussed, in terms of job growth in the Rust Belt. The question is, for Michigan, given the growing importance of water in the future, do you think that the Great Lakes will have a larger impact in the future than perhaps they've had in the past in terms of economic growth for the state? And if so, Are there any arguments there for more policy action to protect the lakes?
Now, since I didn't put the Rust Belt questions up, that question must come from someone that has read the report. I think and then Don can follow me. I think the Great Lakes are one of our biggest assets, our biggest natural asset, I think. And I think in the future it's going to be even a more significant asset. As long as we don't trash it, we've got to be good stewards here.
I think that the natural amenities are one of the comparisons you have to take outside the region, especially the Great Lakes, because essentially, remember, that was a regression of the Great Lakes in the Northeast Midwest region. So a lot of states have the natural amenity of the Great Lakes as part of it. So that's where you want to look. The natural amenities are something where you're trying to compare a broader geography. And I think the other thing, going back to your first question, I think what's also important is to look at how the coefficients are likely to become more significant over time. You could sort of see some things that were trending, as George said, upward, that were more important in the more recent period and less important in the earlier period. So there's some possibility that that actually represents sort of this change. So looking, again, going back to the next 20 years, agglomeration seems to matter less, for example. Crime seemed to matter more in an adverse effect. Education attainment seemed to matter more in the current period. That seemed to be picking up effect, in other words. So I think that's the other question, is try to identify the trends and what variables are going to matter more over the next 20 years.
We continue to answer that question to avoid the other questions.
To what extent is the right to work dummy variable picking up on how poor the South was relative to the North in the late 1960s, and how the wealth gap has narrowed over time, perhaps due to factors besides right to work?
I think that's true to some extent, because you go back to 1929 and you see a narrowing of the income gap by states. I think the other aspect was that the industrial structure in the southern states particularly benefited in the latter period. The expansion of military activity, for example, the presence of those military bases, which were helping some of those, most of the military bases are located in the south, and of course that helped. Oil production, at least through 2009, tended to be located in southern states, Oklahoma, Texas. So I think there was some, Louisiana, some tendency for the South to benefit from some of the industrial structure issues in the, especially in the second, latter period.
I'm not as sure. I guess I just point out, ultimately, it is a dummy variable, and so it's not a fine-tuned measure. It was important for us in this study. We both have preconceived philosophical positions. Some of them are not always the same, actually. But we really wanted to come in here and ask what the data told us, and I think we stuck very closely to that. So I just want to add that. So we're not advocating a position.
The next question is, does Richard Florida have anything valid and significant to say? And if so, then what?
I've forgotten about Richard Florida.
We think so, but we can't prove it, because a lot of his stuff would deal with the sort of the man-made amenities issues. We couldn't construct sort of a consistent man-made amenity metric going back in time over metro areas. I think he's also looking at an issue of the cities versus sort of suburbs. He's looking at specifically at cities as opposed to the metro area. And we were, of course, using metro areas as opposed to central cities.
I think that's an important measure to try to put together, though. I'm really very intrigued by that. but the thought of spending 4 more months constructing data at the moment has reduced my motivation. But I think it's if someone here wants to do that, that's cool. Let me know.
Just to follow up on that question, this is one thing that we discussed a little bit. CloseUp just recently put out a report from the Michigan Public Policy Survey that found that local governments around the state of Michigan are increasingly pursuing placemaking, which is fairly along the lines of what Richard Florida discusses, creating places where people want to live, work, and play with man-made amenities, whether it's nightlife or art museums and theaters and so on. Can you speculate at all what you think if Michigan is kind of limited in the natural amenities that we have in terms of days of sunshine in the winter, whether man-made amenities may be able to close some of the gap?
Well, just remember one thing about the man-made amenities. There's a lot of people who are reading Richard Florida's book, Around the Country, and his papers. And so it's going to be, if they matter, and if everybody is trying to follow his prescription of creating this place, you're not going to gain. This is a zero-sum game in some sense. And so the problem is that essentially if you create a more positive environment in Michigan, but that also happens in Illinois, in Chicago, or Seattle, or Boston, you're not going to gain anything. It's not going to show up in our data. So, in that case, it would be the counterfactual, is you'd lose more, I guess. You'd lose ground. So that's the problem with trying to, if everybody follows the same policy prescription, you're not going to change the results.
Well, I do think that higher amenity areas can experience faster growth, and I think a number of them have. But I think there has to be some level of value-added development that's required to realize that growth. I don't think people are going, or I don't think there's a great flow to places that are just nice. I'm turning to you now, because you're the amenity person.
So, two quick comments on that.
Yes, please.
One is allowed to speak from the peanut gallery. One is, you found strong evidence of one, which is
yes.
Prime.
Yes.
Prime is, and you got the right sign? You got the right sign
yes,
on both your variables?
Yes.
That seems right.
Yeah.
So it was very significant.
True for crime, then can in principle be true for ballet.
Yes.
Perhaps at a smaller, smaller magnitude. The other is, with amenities, they have opposite effects, or they can have opposite effects on income and employment. So you'd expect nice places to actually have lower wages because people are perfectly happy to be there. And that makes them attractive for more employment. And that seemed to me to be also close to consistent with the amenity variables you had. Now, we're not at the level of granularity of Richard Florida amenities, but that they can make a difference, that there are compensating wage differentials for nice places, I think that's pretty well established.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
This follows up. Chicago is certainly one of the draws for Michigan youth graduating with BA degrees. This may be out of your area, though, but let me just throw it. What five things, or let's say what three things, would you recommend to Rahm Emanuel that he do to improve Chicago's economy?
Well, Don lived in Chicago, so I'll toss that one to him first.
It is really cold in Chicago in the winter.
I'd do something about that.
Yeah, that's the weather there is not so nice. It's also very expensive. So if you can find you may be a net loser in real terms, in terms of your wage power if you're buying activity. But people do like Chicago, so it's a good place to visit. Expensive place to live.
What was that? Repeat that again.
What five things?
What two things, including
one thing,
weather?
What's the most important thing that Rahm Emanuel can do for Chicago?
Can he do that, though?
What?
Make it a less expensive place to live.
Yeah, the other thing that may be, and I, it's not in our paper, transit may matter, actually. Mass transit stuff may matter. There's some work that sort of indicates that there may be more benefit to that in terms of attracting young people, more than ballet, which they don't attend.
The study found a positive impact on employment growth based on the economy share of agriculture. Given that Michigan agriculture is a strength in Michigan, are there any policy implications statewide? I know the data is not state-based, but this is a strength for the state of Michigan. Did these findings say anything to policymakers about the agricultural industry?
If you ask me, and when I go to Lansing and do testimony to the legislature twice a year, and have been doing this since 1991, if there is one question we get asked every time, it's about agriculture. Purportedly the second largest industry in the state, and I just remember your quote is one of the second largest industries in the state, along, yes, healthcare, and yes, we could, yeah, I know. You answered it.
Well, the question, you know, agriculture is important. It's actually done well in the state of Michigan. It's probably going to affect smaller metro areas more than suburban Detroit metro area. How do you enhance agriculture? That I don't know.
I mean, we're talking about urban areas here too, and I know you know that, Tom.
But
it also depends on what you define as agriculture.
Yes.
I mean, is it farming? Is it urban farming? Or is it like food processing?
Non-durables manufacturing.
We do pretty well in food processing in this state. So, part of the problem of answering these agriculture problems and questions is I never had a very good definition of it. I mean, some people say people who shelve groceries in grocery stores are agricultural workers. And it doesn't strike me that they're agricultural workers, but anyway, I'm going far afield. Sorry.
The last question is about immigration. Some previous studies have found that immigrants tend to be more entrepreneurial than native-born Americans. But this study found mixed impact or less of an impact in terms of employment growth from the foreign share of the population foreign-born. Governor Snyder certainly is making a big push for immigration in Detroit. Does your study say anything to state policymakers about trying to boost immigrants to Michigan?
Governor Snyder's talking about what he's called skilled immigrants. It's going to be higher paid immigrants. And that's what he's trying to attract. People are worried that this is more competition for jobs here. I will say that in our long-term forecasting, it's really very clear to us that there are going to be fairly significant labor shortages in the economies that make up the U.S. And I would not be surprised if at some point these regions got very competitive to try to get these skilled immigrants. How you do that, I'm a Canadian. I dealt with the immigration authorities. And he's got to have some tricks up his sleeve to deal with those people. They almost booted me out. Anyway, Don, you have some thoughts on that, I know.
This is just all immigrants are the same. And the one thing I've seen in other studies with data is that there's actually a wide variation in the educational attainment of immigrants in Michigan and in the Metro Detroit area. Immigrants are actually much better educated, the foreign-born are much better educated than the native-born population. In some of your southwestern states, where a lot more the Mexican migration
the undocumented Mexican migration comes in, you get a less educated workforce, and that I think is where you begin to see the negative effect on the income side. And if you saw the results for the Great Lakes area, you actually saw a positive effect on the per capita income.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you could tie immigration better to the per capita income stuff than you can to the employment numbers in their mix of educational attainment and how they affect the average wage in the community than on the employment stuff. So I think that was just sort of a bad fit on the employment stuff.
I think we have time for maybe one last question, if we have anyone from the audience.
They want to go home.
Or eat.
Final question? Comments?
Please.
So, I'm not in school here, I'm just a business person, but in the real estate business, we're always looking at sort of these macro trends. And you know, there's a lot of confounds that start to occurring in terms of migration to the south, which was the reversal of maybe migration to the north during the 20s and the industrialization of the United States, or the migration west, and things of that nature. But if I look at cities in terms of what really drove them, and I don't know if your study really addresses it, it's almost like there's maybe an individual that may sort of create that city, in the sense of Detroit, obviously
Henry Ford,
but you can look out into Seattle and say maybe Bill Gates,
yes,
or you can look into, so it's almost one person that creates an incredible economic driver, which then spills out on the rest of the stuff, and I don't know if any of the research you've done touches on that at all.
No, it's certainly true in the early 1900s, and we could list six others, some of them in Michigan, that were recreated because of that. I don't see that as much now. But no, our research didn't really address that.
I mean, obviously you can't predict that, but it's something that I sort of noticed.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who's the guy in St. George, Utah? That's driving your economy. They're the outlier on our employment growth. No, I don't know.
There's one person in this room I know stayed at a hotel in St. George, Utah, so he
I do research all over the world.
I know.
I want to thank Tom, Don, and George, and also invite all of you to join us out in the Great Hall for a reception where you can talk about St. George, Utah, or anything that you like. Before closing, would only note that remind you that the full paper is indeed posted on the Close Up website, which gives you a chance to follow this conversation and look directly at that. The information on that is on the back of your program. With that, would note that a preview of coming attractions, there'll be two major events that the center will be sponsoring in March. One is, it was about this time last year that we worked with colleagues in urban planning to launch a book called The City After Abandonment, which raised questions very pertinent to certainly Detroit, but a number of the jurisdictions of, when you have population and economic contraction, what happens with land? One issue that emerged from that was discussion of Youngstown, Ohio, which many have held up as a possible model for Detroit. We'll actually have a panel conversation that will build on what we did last winter and talk about lessons from the Youngstown experience. Then we'll also be joined in late March, March 25th, I believe, by Kevin Orr, emergency manager for the city of Detroit, who will be taking a break from his very busy schedule. And joining us in that case, not here in Weill Hall, but in the Michigan Union Ballroom. So that's a preview of things to come. Before we close and head out for refreshment, please join me in thanking our panelists.